apparent progress in peace talks between Russia and Ukraine. Moscow says it will drastically reduce its military activity near Kiev. Meantime, Russia warning that NATO's supply of lethal weapons to Ukraine may create a threat to European countries in the future. And British police say they are set to issue the first 20 fines over parties held at Prime Minister Johnson's residence in violation of COVID lockdown rules. This is World News from Tehran with me, Behruz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Now, peace talks between Russia and Ukraine in Istanbul show signs of progress. Moscow has promised to scale down its military operations following, quote, meaningful talks, while Ukraine for the first time outlines potential concessions on territories held by Russia. The Russian Deputy Defense Minister says the talks on the preparation of an agreement on the neutrality and non-nuclear status of Ukraine have moved into a practical field. Alexander Fomin added that his country would now radically reduce military activity near Kiev and the northern city of Chernihiv. Russia's chief negotiator also saying that Moscow is prepared to accelerate the timeline of a possible meeting between President Vladimir Putin and his Ukrainian counterpart, Volodymyr Zelensky. Ukraine also proposed adopting neutral status in exchange for security guarantees. The proposals would also include a 15-year consultation period on the status of Crimea. Turkish foreign minister says that his Russian and Ukrainian counterparts are expected to meet to give the latest shape to the common understanding reached in Tuesday's talks. The Russian defense minister says that Moscow is now focusing on liberating Ukraine's Donbass region after seriously degrading Kyiv's military capacity.
The main objectives of the first phase of the operation have largely been achieved. Combat potential of the Ukrainian armed forces has been substantially degraded, thus allowing us to focus our main attention and main efforts on achieving the primary goal of liberating Donbass.
In a televised meeting with officials, Shoigu also said that Russia is following statements from leaders of several NATO countries who intend to supply warplanes and air defense systems to Ukraine. He warned, however, that Russia would respond appropriately if the Western military alliance went ahead with that decision. Shoigu says that the supply of lethal weapons to Ukraine may create a threat to Europeans themselves.
We consider the position of the West, which supplies lethal weapons to Ukraine, to be irresponsible. Its uncontrolled distribution to the population and mercenaries only exacerbates and may create a threat to the Europeans themselves.
Meantime, Russia has continued its military operation that it says is partly aimed at decapacitating armed Nazi groups in Ukraine. Moscow says it has hit a fuel depot in western Ukraine with cruise missiles. Kiev says that a Russian rocket also hit an administration building in the south, killing three people. More than a month into the conflict, some 4 million Ukrainians have crossed into neighboring countries. Now, meantime, Russia saying it will not supply gas to the EU for free, doubling down on its demand that payments for deliveries be made in rubles. That after the group of seven major economies dismissed the request as unacceptable. The Kremlin spokesman says the companies must understand the changed environment that's created by Western sanctions on Russia over the Ukraine conflict. Dmitry Peskov stressed that the Russian gas is better than all other options. Moscow said last week that it would only accept rubles for natural gas deliveries to unfriendly countries, including the European Union. The G7 says that the request is a unilateral and clear breach of the existing agreements. It's called on energy companies not to comply with the Russian demand. The EU received around 40% of its gas supplies from Russia in 2021. It aims to cut its dependency on Russian gas by two-thirds this year. Now, in other news, British police say that they are set to issue the first 20 fines over parties held at Prime Minister Johnson's office and residence during coronavirus lockdowns. Scotland Yard says that people who are being penalized will be kept secret. But a Downing Street says it will reveal if Johnson is on the list. Now, the announcement came 4 months after the issue sparked an outcry, with the opposition and some of Johnson's own party colleagues asking him to resign. Police investigating 12 gatherings held in breach of lockdown rules in 2020 and the following year. They say that more people could be fined. The prime minister initially denied any such parties, but he later acknowledged and apologized. Meantime, opposition and some ruling party members said that Johnson should resign if he's fined for breaking the rules that he imposed on the rest of the country. Now, Europe is continuing to struggle for an alternative source of oil to replace Russian crude, and then Yemen's war has again hit the headlines, and this after a series of retaliatory strikes by the Yemeni army successfully hitting key Saudi oil infrastructure last week. With petrol prices reaching epic highs, the question is if the Saudi-led war in Yemen could cause more economic hardship on European consumers. Robert Carter has a report.
In the aftermath of Yemen's blistering retaliatory strike on Saudi Arabia's Aramco oil facilities, crude oil prices shot up by over $120 a barrel. Yemen's military spokesperson revealed that the operation had been carried out in response to continued Saudi-led aggression.
Yemen will not hesitate to widen its military operation until the end of the aggression and breaking of the siege. Allah is witness to what we say.
With the threat of future attacks looming, many fear that Saudi's seemingly endless war on Yemen could negatively contribute to economic instability in Europe.
Now we are seeing it's affecting the pounds and the pennies. It's not just Britain. Look at the price of the gasoline and the petrol in the United States, in Germany, everywhere else. Everything is connected, you know, and I think the fact of the matter is today's world, we can't commit these sort of atrocities on one side and think it's not going to come and bite us back later on. And now we are seeing very clear indication of direct impact on our pounds and pennies.
With the relationship between Russia and the West continuing to crumble, Riyadh hopes that it can use this opportunity and Europe's desperate need to replace Russian oil to its own advantage. However, with Yemen's ability to hit key Saudi oil infrastructure at will, serious questions are being raised about the reliability of Saudi as an oil-producing partner. Robert Carter, London.
Now over to Yemen. Now, the army there is saying it's downed the spy aircraft of the Saudi-led coalition flying over the country's central region. Army spokesman General Sari says that a U.S.-made Scan Eagle drone was downed over the province of Marib. Now, that amid a three-day unilateral ceasefire announced by the Supreme Political Council of Yemen on March 26th. The council says the move was aimed at bringing a permanent truce if Riyadh agreed to end the war and blockade. Yemen has brought down tens of drones, and Saudi Arabia, along with some of its regional allies, launched a war in that country in 2015. The war has left hundreds of thousands of people dead and millions more displaced. The UN calls Yemen the largest humanitarian crisis in the world. Now, Iran welcomes Yemen's new peace initiative to end the Saudi-led war. Foreign Ministry spokesman says that the proposed plan shows the determination of Sana'a to bring an end to the war and blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia through political means. He hoped that by giving priority to humanitarian issues and promoting the exchange of prisoners, the crisis would be resolved. Sana'a has announced a unilateral ceasefire, saying it's ready for a permanent truce if Riyadh withdraws its forces, stops supporting local militia, and ends the siege. The UN says that the war on blockade have made Yemen the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Moving on, Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian has left Tehran for China to attend the third meeting of foreign ministers of the country's neighboring Afghanistan. Chinese State Councilor and Foreign Minister Wang Yi will host the two-day meeting in Tunki Anuhi province starting from Wednesday. Top diplomats from Pakistan, Iran, Russia, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan, and the acting foreign minister of Afghanistan's interim government will be in attendance. The meeting will reportedly focus on humanitarian assistance and a call for the U.S. to return Afghan's frozen assets. The first meeting was chaired virtually by Pakistan in September 2021, a day after Taliban announced the formation of an interim government in Kabul. Iran hosted a second round of meeting in October last year. The supporters of opposition political parities in Pakistan have staged a rally against Prime Minister Imran Khan, the capital of Islamabad. The rally was held hours after Parliament took up a no-confidence motion pushed by opposition lawmakers to remove Imran Khan. The House will begin a debate on a motion Thursday, and a vote will be held within 7 days. Imran Khan lost the Parliament in majority with a series of defections from his Tehreek-e-Insaf party, leaving him reliant on coalition allies to sustain power. His opponents believe that they have enough votes to unseat him. Pakistan is grappling with soaring inflation, unemployment, with allegations of corruption and mismanagement plaguing the government. Khan says that a foreign-funded plot is underway to topple him. Kamran Yusuf says the demonstrations against Imran Khan are part of a political turmoil in Pakistan.
As far as rallies are concerned, this is, of course, part of the overall political tension that is brewing in Pakistan since opposition moved a no-confidence motion. We saw a couple of days back, Prime Minister Imran Khan showed his street power in Islamabad, and in response to government's rally, opposition parties last night also gathered on the main highway in the capital, Islamabad, where opposition leaders made fiery speeches and were confident that their move to remove Prime Minister Imran Khan through a vote of no confidence will succeed. As far as the vote of no confidence is concerned, the formal process was kicked off yesterday. Now the session of the National Assembly, the lower house of Pakistan's parliament, will meet again on Thursday when the debate will start on the vote of no confidence. As per the Pakistani constitution, once the resolution is tabled inside the National Assembly, the voting has to take place within 7 days. So we expect that by early next week, the voting will take place and we will have the answer whether Prime Minister Imran Khan will survive.
Canada's indigenous people have met with Pope Francis in the Vatican asking for an apology for the abuse and death of children in Catholic Church-run schools. The Church administered some 60% of government-funded residential schools in Canada between the 1830s and 1990s. Francis already expresses pain at this scandal, but he fell short of offering a formal apology.
Indigenous groups from Canada are visiting the Vatican this week for meetings with the leader of the Catholic Church, Pope Francis. They have held a meeting with the Pope discussing the Church's role in a system of boarding schools that abused Indigenous children for over 100 years as part of a government policy of forced assimilation. That was the Pope's first of four meetings with representatives of Native peoples, referred to as a process of healing and reconciliation. The discovery of more than 1,300 unmarked graves since last May at the schools attended by Indigenous children has opened old wounds. The residential schools were funded by the Canadian government and administered by churches. Canada's Indigenous people are now calling on the Pope to formally apologize as the head of the Catholic Church for its role in administering the facilities.
Untold numbers have now left us without ever having their truths heard and their pain acknowledged, without ever receiving the very basic humanity and healing they so rightfully deserved. That is nothing short of a travesty, both of justice and of conscience. And while the time for acknowledgement, apology, and atonement is long overdue, it is never too late to do the right thing.
The plea was made in a nearly one-hour meeting between the Pontiff and representatives of two of Canada's three largest Indigenous communities, the Métis and Inuit Nations. More than 30 delegates visiting the Vatican say an apology from Francis in Canada would be an important step in the healing process. Survivors of Canada's residential schools have also called on Pope Francis to provide them with unlimited access to church records on the institutions where thousands of Indigenous children were sexually abused and mistreated over the years.
In my opinion, the apology by the Pope would have a limited value, in that it would show that the church is recognizing its culpability and responsibility for the crimes that were committed against the First Nations. The real issue of reconciliation would be the release of documentation and papers concerning the residential schools, which to date the church has not done.
Over the years, the Pope has expressed his sorrow and sadness for the survivors of residential schools in Canada, but has stopped short of apologizing.
Sexual, physical, and emotional abuses, as well as violence, were a common practice in church-run schools in Canada. It became clear after several mass graves containing bodies of Indigenous children were found at former boarding schools last year. An estimated 6,000 First Nation children died or vanished while attending those schools which were established to assimilate them.
Canada has been home to people for thousands of years and was first colonized by Europeans in the 16th century. Settlers took over and began to control Indigenous peoples. Colonizers imposed their own cultural values, religions, and laws, made policies that did not favor the Indigenous peoples. The nominal objective of residential schools was to educate Indigenous children, but the explicit objective was to create a system to isolate them from their own native culture and religion to assimilate them into the white Canadian settlers' culture. The Catholic Church operated nearly three-quarters of Canada's residential schools, seizing more than 150,000 Indigenous children from their homes between 1830s and mid-1990s, spending months or years isolated from their families, language, and culture. Many of the Indigenous children taken from their homes by the church school system were subjected to abuse, rape, and malnutrition. An estimated 6,000 First Nation children died while attending the schools, and the search for more graves goes on. A Truth and Reconciliation Commission concluded in 2015 the failed government policy amounted to cultural genocide.
It would bring, as I said, recognition that they have culpability, and that's been lacking thus far. The church has denied any responsibility for things that happened. They claimed that it was a good thing and that it would help, but what it did was it was a form of genocide. It was cultural genocide, and the church has to claim responsibility for that.
Pope Francis has heard firsthand the horrors of crimes committed at church-run residential schools in Canada from Indigenous survivors. That's a positive step in acknowledging the church's role in this scandal. But will the Catholic Church and Pope Francis offer more than words?
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Leader's New Year Speech. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, delivered a live speech on March 21st, the start of the Iranian calendar year. Ayatollah Khamenei used to deliver the speech at Imam Reza's shrine in Mashhad, but for the third consecutive year, he hadn't gone to Mashhad due to the coronavirus pandemic. The leader started his speech with congratulating Nowruz and beginning of the new solar calendar century. Then he greeted the Imam of the Age, Imam Mahdi, may God expedite his reappearance. He also greeted Imam Reza, peace upon him. Then he reminded important points, which we will touch upon after a short break. Ayatollah Khamenei highlighted two important points on Nowruz. The leader first said that blending this national feast with remembrance of God, supplication and spirituality is somehow unique. Then he continued, at the moment of the turn of the year, each and every person and different strata, from the elderly, the elites, scientists, activists of various scientific fields, including missile, nano, biology, etc., to the youth who spend the feast in remote villages in jihadi expeditions far from their families to serve the people, all started this moment of the turn of the year with the prayer, O Transformer of State and Condition. They spoke with God and appealed to God and washed up their hearts with God's remembrance. This one point, Ayatollah Khamenei then spoke of a second point saying, spring is the symbol of hope. It is the messenger of hope. Spring tells man that autumn and fall of leaves will surely go and freshness, rebuilding and renovation will surely come. This is the feature of spring. It gives the people such a message, the message of freshness, the message of growth. Of course, this hope has been additional in this year because of being accompanied by Mid Sha'ban, which is the birthday of the great hope of history and great hope of mankind and hope of the source of all moves and progresses. So let everyone strengthen the spirit of hope in people in speeches, messages, and Nowruz writings. Let the enemies get angry at the Iranian nation's hopefulness. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, clarified the theme of this year, which he had already named as the year of production, knowledge-based, and job-creating. Explaining knowledge-based economy, he said, it means that knowledge and advanced technology should have ample and complete role in every arena of production. When I say every arena of production, I mean even the choice of that productive work, because one does not need to do all productive works. The choice of that productive work should also stem from a scientific and deep-sighted look. This is the meaning of knowledge-based economy, which is involved in all economic arenas. Once we pursue this policy and set knowledge as the basis and background of the country's economy and increase knowledge-based economic agencies, which I am going to explain, it will have many benefits for the country and the country's economy. It will decrease cost. It means that knowledge-based economy will cause reduction of production cost. It will increase productivity, which is one of our problems today. It will increase and improve the quality of the product and will make products competitive. The leader gave an example in agriculture, saying that an increase of knowledge-based companies can cause great developments. It will provide food security and the country will never face food problems. It will increase farmers' income and solve the chronic problem of water shortage. He added, in all other sections, too, whether the parts related to production or the sections related to services, these blessings exist. I mean the volume of production will increase, quality will be enhanced, and the cost price will decrease. In fact, making production knowledge-based will enhance economic activities. This is an important issue. It is a sensitive and fundamental point. Ayatollah Khamenei referred to 6,700 knowledge-based companies in Iran, saying, I expect the officials to double the number of knowledge-based companies in the new year to meet the needs of the country. In this way, creation of 300,000 direct jobs will turn into 600,000 direct jobs in 1401, the current year. The leader stressed that the increase of the number of knowledge-based companies is quite feasible with regards to the potentials of the country. He said, people and youth form these companies, yet government establishments should support them. Support mainly means to buy and use their products or provide them with facilities if they need any. According to reports, a high percentage of educated persons are employed in irrelevant fields, whereas we can use the endeavor of specialized and young forces who are the greatest wealth of the country to make the country wealthy. Ayatollah Khamenei continued, job creation will be achieved via these very knowledge-based companies. It means that if we are able to produce and create these companies in the true sense of the word, so that we will not make the mistakes that would sometimes be made in the past, jobs will increase. The leader of the Islamic Revolution stressed his previous warning on not tying the economy to sanctions and said, fortunately, the current policies in the country showed that this is a correct word and they did the same thing. Although there are American sanctions, one can enhance and increase foreign economy, which was increased. One can both enter regional contracts, which, thank God, the government ably entered and achieved progresses and enhancements in the field of oil and other fields. One can reach better situation, which, thank God, has occurred, although the American sanctions exist. Of course, I never say that we should not try to remove sanctions. No, I have said several times that there is no harm in the efforts that some people are making in this field. Let them pursue it. But the basis of the issue is for us to move and administer the country in a way that sanctions won't be able to deal a basic and serious blow to it. Ayatollah Khamenei referred to the increase of oil and dollar prices and said, these revenues can be dealt with in two ways. They can either be spent on increase of imports, thinking that this will increase people's welfare and comfort. Although this looks good, it has a very bad inward, and in fact, it means to destroy the fundamental assets of the country. Another way, which is the correct and basic way, is to use oil revenues for construction of the country's infrastructures and bolstering the foundations and deepening the roots of economy, which must be done. Ayatollah Khamenei then said, When you look at what is taking place in the world, you will see the rightfulness and honesty of the Iranian nation in confronting the front of arrogance more clearly than ever. Our nation's choice against arrogance was not submission. It was steadfastness, non-dependence, keeping independence, internal strengthening of the system, nation, and country. These are national decisions. This was correct. The leader briefly referred to the current developments and said, "This is Afghanistan. That is Ukraine, whose president addresses the West, while the Westerners and Western governments themselves have brought him to power with a harsh tone. These are the events of Yemen, an everyday bombardment of the oppressed and really resistant people of Yemen. These are the works of Arabia, which beheads 80 people in a single day. 80 youths and even teenagers whose news was spread. When one looks at these events, he feels, what oppression is ruling in the world? What a darkness is ruling in the world? The world is in the hand of what bloodthirsty wolves?" Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei concluded his speech with a sad reference to the Western racist approach and double standard policies. He said, "They explicitly express sorrow that this time war is not in the Middle East and is in Europe." It means that if there is war, bloodshed, and fratricide in the Middle East, in the regions of what they call as Middle East, and in these places, there is no problem. But if it is in Europe, there is such an explicit racism. This is another instance of duplicity in the Western world in the face of oppression and injustice, to the extent that if it occurs in their subject countries, they will show no reaction whatever, and they masquerade human rights with this much of oppression and injustice, and blackmail independent countries with this false claim. In the end of his speech, the leader called for solidarity, coherence, synergy, and unity among officials and various strata of the nation in a bid to achieve the goals of the Islamic Revolution.
He who asks questions cannot avoid the answers. A simple question.
There's trouble in London's police service at New Scotland Yard. They state, "Our vision for the Met is to be the most trusted police service in the world. We contribute to making London the safest global city. We protect its unique reputation as an open and welcoming city. And we want Londoners to be proud of their police." However, a series of damaging cases involving people who have served as London police officers may have undermined the credibility of the Met's ability to sustain the confidence and trust of the general public.
In late 2021, two UK police officers pleaded guilty to sharing photos of the bodies of two murdered sisters at a crime scene they were assigned to protect. In court, officers Dennis Jaffa and Jamie Lewis admitted sharing the images.
"Are you going to apologise for what you did?"
"Today they admitted misconduct. In
Other officers have been accused of abandoning an alleged domestic abuse victim in a flat shared with her potentially violent partner, with police allegedly telling her, "There is nothing we can do." Worse still, former police officer Wayne Cousins was convicted of abducting Sarah Everard in a London street as she walked home, then raping and murdering her in a case that has shocked Britain. Her body was found in woodland 80 kilometres away in southeast England. The Everard case has stirred protests over violence against women by the police. The impact of these convictions involving officers has been felt inside and outside the police service. The Metropolitan Police Force, which investigated the murder by Cousins, said it was sickened, angered and devastated by his crimes. Commissioner Cressida Dick apologised, while Labour Party politician Harriet Harman called on Dick to resign, adding, "Women must be able to trust the police, not fear them. Women's confidence in police will have been shattered." Even Prime Minister Boris Johnson added, "Our police are there to protect us, and I know that officers will share in our shock and devastation at the total betrayal of this duty."
How can people who have committed criminal acts of violence pass the recruitment process for a police force? What impact have recent convictions of police officers in London for serious law-breaking offences had on public confidence in the law enforcement services? Simple questions with important answers. And let's start with this. What, in terms of the public's view, constitutes a reasonable standard of behaviour for police officers? We put that to the public here in central London. This is what they told us. Generally, what do you expect in terms of standards of behaviour from any police force? What do you want the police, how do you want them to behave?
I want them to be supportive, but not like judge people based on obviously looks or gender or anything like that. I don't want them to be scary. I don't want to be like they're facing towards me and I become scared of them.
Well, one would hope for high standards, but just lately, probably not.
At least 50% better than they are at the moment.
Yes.
But they have a hard time. They've got so many things that they're controlled to do, like racial things, abuse of people.
Just to meet the basic, like the citizen needs, like if they need any help with directions, or if you see that they're like in trouble, just to assist, just to help out. If you see someone stealing, but they're stealing like diapers type of thing, then you just like help out, I guess. That's a policeman's job anywhere around the world, I feel like.
Yes.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yes.
You know, not behave in the way that we've seen recently in the news, in terms of we want to be able to trust them.
Yes.
And feel that we're in safe hands.
Yes.
So there needs to be a very strong code of conduct, and if people don't follow that code of conduct, then they need to go. The job's not right for them.
Just like security, like if you ever like, you know, if something ever happened that you could phone them and they would be there quite quickly.
For them to treat everyone equally, not to treat people different, look different than others. I'd expect them to be polite to the public, to look. I think you want to see a police officer and feel that they're safe to approach and you know, yeah.
I think throughout COVID it's probably changed a little bit. Less aggressive, to be honest, what I've seen on the news. I know they've got a hard job to do, but I think on the news lately they haven't been portrayed very well.
And the tourists, they don't know particularly about the people that they can take away their bags or their phones, like me, that I hand my phone. So I expect to protect those people and do not leave it like this, like, okay, just leave it happen. It's something that can happen every day.
Good discipline, really. Around, obviously, a lot of presence.
I think just being available for the public when they need them.
Well, I expect them to be respectful and to consider the needs of the people that they're protecting.
I think they should be courteous,
They should be there and available for you to speak to.
Two police officers admitted sharing photos of two murdered women in London on a social network. How does the public feel about their actions?
Yeah, that's a different kind of situation there too, obviously. I mean, as you say, when a police officer, you obviously want your 100% faith in themselves, you trust them, don't you, really? And stuff like that, so obviously, yeah, there's no excuse, there's no for that, is there, really? You can't excuse that at all.
I think it's horrendous, and what's probably worse is they shared it and other people looked at them and presumably quite enjoyed them, and it's awful.
I think they should get fired. That's definitely confidential, so they shouldn't be sharing that. Yeah.
That's disgusting. Absolutely disgusting. Now, I work for the NHS and we see some difficult things at work, and it's gross misconduct if you share any information about your patients or any images, and I would expect the police to behave in exactly the same way. And to have a WhatsApp group, you know, it's just terrible.
You wouldn't expect that from police officers. They're meant to be there to keep you safe, so that just really angers me whenever I hear that. Yeah.
First, I've heard of it, but it obviously sounds wrong.
Yeah.
But I mean, you just inherently think that's wrong just as a person, not a policeman or otherwise. Just as a human, you wouldn't do that, would you?
At the scene of a crime, that's terrible. I don't think any private things should be taken or shared. It's police material should not be shared with the public.
I think that's very, very, very bad and very unrespectful towards the woman, but also like the family towards this woman.
I think that's definitely sort of part over the line as such, definitely not professional and shouldn't happen, really.
I don't know the details of that particular incident, but if that was done without consideration of their privacy or was not part of some kind of formal release of investigation, then I think there's probably some wrongdoing there.
I think it's a boundary that has been crossed. I don't think that that's the right thing to do.
Just not having any clue of the feelings of the families or all people. Like, you know, you're dealing with this traumatic event and you just don't have the compassion to understand how traumatic this is for everyone. If you're taking photos and being a tourist about it, we're kind of losing the point of being a person.
Social media is probably 90% of the problem. And I think anybody that uses that platform to accentuate any crime or reveal and share is rather disturbed, to be honest.
A London police officer has been jailed for life for raping and murdering a woman called Sarah Everard. How is it that a murderer was able to serve in the police? Here's the public's opinion.
Perhaps, you know, there needs to be tightened regulations or a reevaluation of how, you know, we select the police. Or
they should obviously have to go up against a platform of where there's some kind of, you know, control or procedure that's put in place, like it was in the old days in the United Kingdom.
I guess, like, you never know who the bad guy is until something happens.
It got through the loophole somehow because, I presume they do checks. Some things weren't picked up, so something's gone wrong there. I mean, there are bad people in all walks of society.
Maybe they just didn't do enough background checks on him before he went into the police force. Maybe they need to get more, tighter on security checks on who's going into the police.
Well, how would anyone know that someone is going to do that, right? And you can only run a criminal background check on someone if they've been convicted of a crime. So if they've been suspected and weren't indicted on it, weren't convicted of it, then there's no record of it.
I wonder the same thing. But then also rapists and murderers are also a bit everywhere. It's just sad that they're also in the police force because you think, if I want to be police, I'm a good person and should follow the law. And also leads to more, scariness because why should I trust the police if they also murder me? And like that.
Yeah, how do they? I wouldn't be best to answer that. I'm sure they get vetted before they start the role, but it's not nice. But it could happen in any profession, I suppose. But yeah, again, it's you'd expect it not to happen in the police, but these things do happen, unfortunately.
Well, there's obviously a lot of police personnel, so anyone can get in really. Again, it's down to the individual. I wouldn't say that's them as a whole, and to say it is them as a whole is completely wrong, in my opinion.
It's a very sad news, and I think it puts the entire police on a very bad spot.
Well, I don't think, say, mental illness or those type of issues, they have no bounds. It doesn't matter what your career is or how intelligent you are.
I should think the vetting process needs to be more studied and more thorough when they either at recruiting stage or progressively through their life.
Here are the facts. The London Metropolitan Police employs almost 33,000 officers in the front line to try and keep law and order in a city with a population of around 10 million people. Yet, since 2005, 26 Met officers were convicted of sex crimes, 27 of theft, and 72 were convicted of violence against other people. Has public confidence been affected by these latest convictions? A poll in October 2021 revealed 63% of those polled trusted the police in general, but only 33% trusted the Metropolitan Police. In the same poll, 31% said they did not trust the police in general, but that lack of trust rises to 43% for the London Metropolitan Police, meaning that more people distrust the London Met than trust them.
Given all these recent revelations, what level of trust do the people here in London feel able to give their police force?
Ooh, that's a loaded question.
would you make a call and feel safe, or?
I would make a call. Yeah, I mean, because at the end of the day, you still have to trust that the government is working.
You would go to them, but not perhaps one on his own.
Yes.
You'd want two.
Difficult to say, because I think the Londoners have come to accept it. Visitors, depending on where they come from, might find it strange to have that sort of police force in somewhere like civilised world like the UK.
I think anywhere in the world that stuff happens. Like, the police and the government's corrupt anywhere.
It's an isolated incident, and I would say 99.9% of police officers are doing the job for the right reason. You can't tar them all with the same brush.
I do still trust the police because that was one person, but, yeah, it's just, it makes it quite difficult, you know, to trust them after hearing that.
How many policemen are there in London, policemen or women? I'd say this is a very, very small minority, surely, of the force as a whole, in which case I'd be likely to trust them.
Not really so much trust, because, like, when I see them or, like, when they're around the area, I want to feel like, okay, safe, they're here. But if I know that they also do this and that it happens often, of course I don't feel safe around them.
To be honest, not very much, unfortunately. I have here 2 years, and to be honest, I don't have seen much effort from the police to do their best to protect their people, the residents here.
Just because, you know, that's what you see in the news and the paper, so that's the sort of front face of the police, is the negative stuff. I do think the police do a lot of positive as well that doesn't necessarily get reported on.
Well, the fact that if it's been confirmed that someone like that has been serving in our police, and particularly if it's been known for a while and action hasn't been taken, then it reduces our trust.
There's a lot of crime in the police force happening, so I think it's hard to say 100% yes.
Well, I guess you do somewhat not. It does reduce your trust.
You know, you have these kind of incidents all over the world, and I don't think London policing or the police force in the United Kingdom should be held to blame for an incident like that.
Well, that's not fair to lump all the police together, so I think there's still trust in the London police.
Looking at the situation from an international perspective, what image does this police behaviour generate to the wider world about the way law and order is carried out in the capital of the United Kingdom?
I guess you just got to be cautious. It scares people, like, not to be able to trust the police officers.
I mean, I've come to London this weekend, you know, these few days to visit, and I was walking around late last night. I probably feel safer here than I do in my own home, if I'm honest, because there's lots of people around, and, you know, it feels busy and it's well lit.
It did make me quite scared because I lived in London during the pandemic and I heard about that girl getting murdered. So it just makes you think, like, is this good? Is the security here good, you know, in London? And, like, as a girl, do you feel safe walking home at night when you're hearing that? Yeah. So I'd say it just does scare you a bit. Yeah.
Those examples obviously aren't good, but in general, I'd surely say that the police are doing a good job.
I think it scares everybody, really. And, I mean, as a tourist myself, I don't really feel so safe walking around here when the police is doing this.
I don't think we should be preaching to internationally to any country, to be honest. We should look closer to home first before we start preaching out, should I say, so to speak. Yeah.
Well, information now travels very, very fast in nowadays, and you know, immediately everybody will know in the other countries. So, and everybody talks about it, and for sure it can it does damage to the image of the police here in Great Britain. Absolutely.
I definitely think it'll have a negative effect. You know, it's sort of the first impressions, isn't it? If that's sort of the first you hear about British police or English police, and it's a negative story, then that sets it up for the future. And
I think it projects an image that this not being correctly managed at the highest levels, and more needs to be done. And I imagine that other nations looking in would wonder, well, if you're allowing that to happen, what else are you allowing to happen too? And therefore breeding greater distrust overall, not only for our own police services, but perhaps breeding mistrust in other aspects of our public services.
I think that it's really sad, and it puts a bad image on the London police.
I think it is a real eye-opener.
It is definitely going to affect, because the people coming from other countries are definitely going to think wrongly.
Whether they break the law themselves, they need to be reprimanded, or whether they're carrying out the law, they need to serve and protect with the utmost integrity and respect for the public as well, because that is their vow and the pledge that they take.
A catalogue of offences uncovered by investigations and confirmed in court has served to keep London's police force in the media for all the wrong reasons. While the UK has previously criticised other countries for their failures in law and order, London's own police force appears a case study in offences admittedly by a small number of individuals, but nevertheless, these cases have undermined the credibility of the force. And some would say it's authority to preach to other countries about enforcement standards.
Revelations and court cases against members of the London Police have damaged confidence in the force. These have also raised questions about the public's level of trust in the police in London. Now, most police do an excellent, honest and difficult job. However, public opinion suggests that trust, which takes a long time to build, can be quickly lost. It is a substantial challenge for the Metropolitan Police to win back what it has lost in terms of that public confidence, and some would say its international reputation, due to the illegal actions of an irresponsible, violent, and even murdering few members of the force.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran.
You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.